Members of the audience will be permitted to make points on behalf of one side or the other. Please, no questions addressed to the debate as the rules forbid their responding. Finally, the lead debaters, beginning this time with Mr. McAdams and concluding with Mr. Hawkins, will have 10 minutes to present their closing statements. Following that, I'll ask the House to divide, left or right, depending on which side you think won the debate, and I'll declare a winner. Then we'll adjourn for refreshments and good fellowship. Speakers, I shall ring this bell when a minute remains to your time, and again when your time has expired. At that second ring, please conclude your sentence and retire. Should I rise, please retire at once. One final word to the audience. As these debates follow the austere Oxford-Cambridge format, we do not applaud at any time. Should you strongly agree with a speaker, expressions of "hear, hear" will be permitted. Should you find a point utterly beyond the pale,
shame, shame.
That's right, Dean Baker. Not in my entire academic life have I ever disagreed with my dean, which accounts for the fact that I still have an academic life. Debaters, good luck to you all. We'll begin with Mr. Hawkins.
Well, nearly 80 years ago, there was a similar debate in New York City with Clarence Darrow, the leading criminal defense lawyer of his time, debating on the issue of the death penalty. The question then was, the proposition was, the death penalty is a wise form of public policy. Well, I'm happy to know that 80 years later, the question has been changed to, should the death penalty be abolished? And I am firmly in support of it being abolished. Why? Why must the death penalty go? Why must it be eradicated from all the years that it has been part of our criminal justice policy? The question, I think, my friends, goes to the fact that this punishment, it's not what it does to the murderer, but it's what it does to us as a society. How does it change us? How does it degrade us? How does it make us less than the full human beings that we're capable of being? Justice Brandeis, years ago, said the government is the great teacher. And if government teaches people to kill, then what message does that send? If the government says that the only way we can deal with murderers is to kill them, we are sending the message that not that murder is wrong, but that murder is right, that murder is a fine, justified, formal way to deal with problems in our society. Look around us. We see young people going into schools and shooting, right? They're taking the law into their hands to solve and find a solution to the problems that they face, right? How does government reinforce that? By ceremoniously taking a human life, by saying that this is the only way that we can deal with the violence within our culture? Think about how the government, through the ritual of executions, has an impact. My office, my organization, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, coined the phrase a long time ago, why do we kill people to show people that killing people is wrong? Kind of doesn't make sense, does it? It kind of stands the whole argument on its head. No, we cannot teach people anything by killing. We can go back to the Italian jurist Cesare Beccaria, who wrote on Crimes and Punishment in 1764. He said that the death penalty cannot be useful because of the example of barbarity it gives men. When the dean talked a moment ago about the fact that, when Professor Zelnick talked about the fact that we did not inherit 350 crimes punishable by death from England, it was because of the Italian jurist Beccaria, who helped to influence our jurisprudence back then. But it's so important that he said, because of the example of barbarity it gives to men. Others have spoken about this. Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov said, I reject the notion that the death penalty has any essential deterrent effect on potential offenders. I am convinced that the contrary is true, that savagery begets only savagery. What else do we know about the death penalty from a moral standpoint? is there any redemptive capacity to these 3,000-plus people who are on death row? We know that after Furman v. Georgia was a case where the Supreme Court struck down the death penalty in 1972. There were about 500 people on death row at the time. Of all those people, they were released. Most of them were released. A handful of them committed homicide again in their lives. Two of them became college professors. So, gentlemen, you find yourself in great company. We know that there are others, great examples in our culture. The actor Charles Dutton, who at one time committed homicide, now he's an acclaimed actor, right? He was able to turn his life around. Think about someone like Dr. Martin Luther King, one of your esteemed graduates of BU. Dr. King believed that within all of us there was the redemptive capacity, that we could rise above the worst deed in our lives, as Sister Helen Prejean puts it, that we all could be more than our worst deed. Think about what kind of society we would have had if Dr. King didn't believe that. We would have had a race war in this country of episodic proportions, right? But he believed that people, even the most virulent Southern racists, could be redeemed, that there were qualities to be culled out of that human spirit. And we see it again and again and again in all the people who've been released from death row. Lastly, who are we to play God? This is my last point with respect to morality. What gives us the right to make this determination? How do we make this determination? Are we ever careful that we can ever make it right? Who are we, with all of our faults and foibles, to somehow make this ultimate decision as to who lives and who dies? Who are we to make that decision? And that's a perfect segue into my next point, and that is that we are fallible as human beings. We know that with 805 people having been executed in this country, 102 have been released, exonerated from death row. Okay? That's not legal technicalities, hard evidence that helped these people be released. Think about that. That means that for every 8 people that's executed, one person is released from death row on grounds of innocence. If you knew that a plane that you were going to fly in, that every 8 trips landed safely, but 1 out of 8 trips crashed, do you think the government would allow planes to fly in the air? Of course not. Of course not. But we allow this punishment to exist knowing that it has that kind of high rate of error. Since 1993, with the arrival of DNA technology, 20% of all the people who've been released from death row on grounds of innocence have been released because of DNA. That's 20%. Thank you. That's 20% since 1993, right, folks? So what does that mean then if people have been released from death row since 1973 because of innocence? What does it mean for all those people before then? Right? That means that there may have been 20% of people who just were not caught, who were executed in this country. If we know that 20% of the people have been released from death row because of DNA evidence, DNA technology, after it came online in 1993, then what happened to the people before then? We will never know, because the problem is that this punishment literally buries its mistakes. It's irreversible. It's irrevocable. Speaking to the chamber, to the French Chamber of Deputies in 1830, after witnessing the excesses of the French Revolution, the Marquis de Lafayette had this to say. He said, "I shall ask for the abolition of the punishment of death until I have the infallibility of human judgment demonstrated to me." He said that in 1830. We're still waiting for the infallibility of human judgment to be demonstrated. It simply is not possible, folks. My adversaries may get up and say, "Well, you know, the problem is Mr. Hawkins has not produced the body to show that an innocent person has been executed." That's absurd. We have someone like Anthony Porter released off of death row in Illinois. This man got a stay in his execution because of a question about his mental retardation, right? I remember he was up on our board because we track every execution. He got a stay for a few weeks. Do you know that within those few weeks, journalism students, some like you all in this room, were able to find the actual killer, get a videotape confession, which to me is still amazing, bring that to court, and William Anthony Porter is off of death row today. That wasn't because of the law. The law had nothing to do with that. If those journalism students had not been as conscientious as all of you, this man would be dead right now. And how would that be proved? I wouldn't be able to prove it. I wouldn't be able to prove it at all. Because the person who had done the crime would just be quiet and go about their lives. Like I said, folks, this punishment buries its mistakes. We have had even Supreme Court justices point this out. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor recently said that if statistics are any indication, the system may be allowing some innocent defendants to be executed. That's Sandra Day O'Connor, who sits on the Supreme Court. She sits a lot closer to the action than me or any of my adversaries. And if she says that people, innocent people, are falling through the cracks as a sitting justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, appointed by Ronald Reagan, a Republican from Arizona, conservative justice, if she is saying that's the case, then that has to be. Moving on to my last point, and that is, what about the victims? Don't victims have a right to see the person executed, right? Isn't that what we hear again and again and again? Well, let's first classify all of these victims. Isn't my friend Juan Melendez, who spent 17 years, 8 months, and 1 day on death row for a crime he did not commit and released just last year from Florida, is not he a victim and can't get one red cent from the state of Florida, right? Do all of you know that there is no special compensation fund for these people who lose all those years of their lives? And what about the mother or father who has their son or daughter executed and can't get counseling afterwards? Aren't they also a victim? But just think about them for a minute, but let's go to the heart of it. The heart of it being those victims whose loved ones have been murdered. We have within our coalition an organization called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. These are people like my friend Bud Welch, whose daughter Julie was killed in Oklahoma City, who rejects capital punishment. And Bud says that it has that believing in the death penalty in no way helped him move through his anger and the healing process that he had to go through. Or Marietta Yeager, another friend of mine whose 7-year-old daughter was raped and murdered. And she says, Marietta says, look, forgiveness is not for wimps. It's tough work. But I had to work through that in order to be healthy, in order to go on with my life, in order to reconcile this horrible thing that happened in my life and be able to move on. What does it mean to be a victim in this sense? And how are victims classified? Rennie Cushing, who heads Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, he says, you know, Steve, it's almost like there are two types of victims. Good victims, those who want the death penalty, those who you see on the 5 o'clock news and the prosecutor brings them out. And then there are the bad victims, those that don't want the death penalty. And Rennie talks about how the prosecutors treated he and his family, and Marietta talks about it, and others talk about it, like Suzanne Bosler. They were treated horribly because they did not support the death penalty. The only time we've ever heard of instances where families do not wish to have the death penalty have been high-profile cases, like when Bill Cosby lost his son. Or there have been sensational cases like Matthew Shepard, the gay man who was killed in Wyoming, whose family did not want the death penalty. But most of the time, we never hear about these people. And I tell you, my friends, at least 50% of those people who lose their loved ones to homicide do not want the death penalty. But you don't know about that. So this whole fallacy, this whole argument that all victims want the death penalty is absolutely wrong. And you should question that. As I close, I want to point out the words of Coretta Scott King, who spoke at our first national conference in 1981. And she had this to say. She said, as someone whose husband and mother-in-law have died the victims of murder and assassination, I stand firmly and unequivocally opposed to the death penalty for those convicted of capital offenses. An evil deed is not redeemed by an evil deed of retaliation. Justice is never advanced in the taking of a human life. Morality is never upheld by a legalized murder. Coretta Scott King lost her husband, Martin Luther King Jr. I think she gives the most powerful and eloquent words that anyone can end this discussion on, and I thank you.
Please hold the applause. Thank you very much, Mr. Hawkins, our lead debater for the negative side, is John McAdams.
You'll often find death penalty opponents making arguments about the death penalty that they would never think of making about other punishments. For example, it's said that we degrade people by imposing the death penalty. Is imprisonment degrading? Ironically, the liberal activists who oppose the death penalty in other contexts, if the death penalty weren't up for debate, are the same people who'd be telling you, for example, that the criminal justice system is racist from top to bottom, that there are too many young black men who are in prison, for example, for drug crimes. They would be telling you that prisons are barbaric. They would be telling you that it's inhumane to imprison people. But because the subject is the death penalty, they conveniently ignore the question of what else would we do if not the death penalty. They say that when we levy the death penalty, the government is teaching us to kill. I think, in fact, it's teaching people not to kill. Is it the case, for example, that when we imprison people for kidnapping, we're teaching people that kidnapping is okay? Isn't government kidnapping? If we fine corporations that have defrauded their investors, aren't we repaying evil with evil? They took money away. We take their money away. It's simply a fact about punishment that you repay evil with evil when you set about punishing someone. And their side, I don't think, will admit that they don't believe in punishing people. In 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded the country of Kuwait. We mounted our own counter-invasion and kicked him out. Were we teaching him that invasion is all right, or were we teaching him that invading another country is not all right? I say the latter. They say that the death penalty is irreversible. It's true that when you execute someone, you can't bring them back to life. But suppose we put people in prison for 10 or 20 or 30 years. Can we reverse that? Well, we can let them out, but we can't give people their lives back. That is irreversible, too. So you find them making arguments against the death penalty that if they were consistent, they would have to make... Do we have a right to play God with people's lives? Well, do we have a right to play God with people's lives and put them in prison? Isn't that playing God? If we execute someone, do we limit the possibility of redemption? Of course we do. But what possibilities have we precluded? What possibilities have we taken away when we put someone in prison? Lots of possibilities. The death penalty is clearly worse than life imprisonment. That's why it's the supreme punishment. But the principle is the same. You'll find the opponents of the death penalty throwing around a lot of numbers that are, in fact, well, often rather nonsensical. Let me give you an example. We've heard that 50% of victims' families oppose the death penalty. I'd like a source on that. I'd like to know who has done the survey and how they found it out. We're told that 20% of 102 supposed innocent people were let off the hook because of DNA evidence. I looked at the list a couple of years ago very carefully when it had 95 people on it, and only 10 people were let off because of DNA evidence. We're told that 102 innocent people have been put on death row and then let off. How do we know that they're innocent people? In a few cases, we have fairly decisive DNA evidence. In other cases, what we basically have is the word of death penalty opponents. Now, if we were talking about statistics produced by the National Rifle Association about how many gun owners save their lives by picking up a pistol that they had handy, you quite properly would be skeptical of those numbers. Please be equally skeptical of numbers produced by political activists on the other side. A couple of years ago, I actually looked at the list and analyzed it very carefully. It contained 95 people. Several had been let off for procedural reasons, not because there was any positive evidence of their innocence. 17 were let off because of alleged police or prosecutor misconduct. 11 because of ineffective counsel. 7 because of other procedural irregularities. In 11 cases, a higher court simply believed the evidence was insufficient, obviously disagreeing with the lower court judge, prosecutors, and the jury. They may have been right, they may have not been right. But all these people were let off for procedural reasons, not because they were known to be innocent. 32 people on the list were retried. That is to say, the prosecutors continued to believe that they were guilty and retried them. Probably a substantial number of additional people, the prosecutor was convinced of their guilt, but simply declined to retry them, either perhaps, for example, because key evidence had been suppressed, or, you know, often this is several years later, witnesses can have died, moved away. So you really don't know how many innocent people have been put on death row. It's a lot less than 102. Given that there have been a little over 6,700, at least as when I analyzed the list, 6,700 death sentences since 1973, the number of innocents is almost certainly less than 1% of people who have been convicted of murder and put on death row. Now, the other side will say, hey, that's too many. There shouldn't be anybody. What they pay very little attention to is how many people who've been convicted and sent to prison for long prison terms or life are innocent. The answer is, we don't know. There are people trying to, you know, there's, for example, the Innocence Project, that find a substantial number of people put in prison are in fact innocent, or at least they claim them to be innocent. But the truth is, nobody pays nearly as much attention to the issue of innocence when we just put somebody in jail and lock the door. We pay vastly more attention to whether someone is in fact guilty or innocent when they are sentenced to death than we do when they're just given, you know, 40 years or given life imprisonment. That, in fact, is one of the virtues of the death penalty. We take the question of real innocence and guilt quite seriously where the death penalty is concerned. We take it much less seriously otherwise. For example, there are movements in state legislatures to provide better counsel for people who are facing the death penalty. I think that's all well and good, but let me give an example. In Indiana, if you're facing a capital murder charge, you can hire two lawyers and they can bill the state of Indiana $90 an hour to work as many hours as they want to in your case. That does not buy the cream of the legal profession, but what happens if you're charged with murder and it's not a capital murder? Well, you get represented by a public defender who makes a minimum salary of a little over $41,000 a year. A lot of them make $60,000 or $70,000 a year. Any would-be law students in here, could I see hands? Anyone who's a would-be law student? You can expect to make a lot more than that when you get out. And these lawyers have a fixed caseload of between 150 and 200 new assignments per year. In other words, Indiana is providing much better legal counsel to people accused of capital murder than people accused of non-capital murder. It's good that they're providing good legal counsel for these people. Why aren't they providing better legal counsel for people who are charged with non-capital murder? Well, because we care. Access to DNA evidence, same thing, same thing. A big movement to give people on death row access to DNA evidence. Nobody's paying a lot of attention where it's just someone with a 10-year or 20-year prison sentence. Has anyone who is, in fact, innocent been executed? Opponents of the death penalty cannot name one case. Many of you have probably heard of a guy named Barry Scheck, co-founder of the Innocence Project. He was interviewed by Matt Lauer of NBC. It was in an anti-death penalty conference in Chicago, and Matt Lauer asked, since 1976, 486 people have been executed in this country. Any doubt in your mind that we've put to death innocent people? Scheck responded, well, you know, I think that we must have put to death innocent people, but if you're saying to me, prove it right now, I can't. They can't point to any innocent person who they say the evidence says that they have been put to death. And now, I'll admit that eventually, if we execute enough people, we'll put someone to death who is innocent. Does that mean that the death penalty is therefore illegitimate? You might ask this question. Is it illegitimate to go to war, even though there might be some innocent noncombatants killed? What if the choice is an occasional... Is it illegitimate for the Food and Drug Administration to approve a drug that will save a lot of lives, but is likely to kill a few people because of arcane reactions? What if the choice is between eventually putting somebody who's innocent to death or imprisoning dozens or even scores of innocent people, imprisoning them because, again, where it's just prison that is at issue, we don't pay that much attention to actual guilt. Finally, let me talk just a little bit about deterrence. The other side is going to insist to you that the death penalty has no deterrent effect. Sometimes the statistics they'll prove are mind-numbingly simplistic. They'll compare states that have the death penalty with states that don't have the death penalty, leaving entirely aside the issue of whether anybody is actually executed. That's clearly a boneheaded way to do it. When you do the numbers right, it is in fact the case that a lot of studies don't show any deterrent effect of the death penalty, but several studies, particularly very good studies, and particularly rather recent studies, do show a deterrent effect of the death penalty. For example, you might check a very recent study by Dale Cloninger in Applied Economics, a study that's coming out in a few months in another economics journal done by a guy named Hashim Dejba, who's the chair of the economics department at Emory University, a paper titled Pardons, Executions, and Homicide by Naki Mokan and Kej Gottings. They're economists at the University of Colorado at Denver. So the evidence on that is mixed, and there are some good studies, particularly done by economists, that show a deterrent effect. Now, the issue is this. If there might be a deterrent effect, what do we do? If, in fact, we have the death penalty, if, in fact, there is no deterrent effect, and we execute people anyway, we've executed a bunch of murderers. If, in fact, there is a deterrent effect of the death penalty, and we fail to execute murderers, we have allowed the killing of a substantial number of innocent people. I don't find this a difficult issue, folks. I would rather take risks with the lives of murderers than I would take risks with the lives of innocent citizens. So until the other side can absolutely prove that there's no deterrent effect, I think the prudent course of action is to execute people guilty of the most heinous cases of aggravated murder.
Thank you, Professor McAdams. Our student debater is Sandhya Ganapathy.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. We've all heard the old adage, but is this really the society that we want? Would we steal from a petty thief? Would we burn down the home of an arsonist? Would we rape a rapist? Clearly, the answer is no, and yet, in the United States, we would murder a murderer. In 1976, the Supreme Court decided to reinstate the death penalty, and since then, the number of executions per year has skyrocketed. I'm here to talk to you about the death penalty from two perspectives, international relations and economics, two fields which I study. Let's start with economics. For a moment, I want you to put aside your religious beliefs, your moral convictions, and be purely utilitarian. Economists like to do a cost-benefit analysis. If the benefit is equal to the cost or the benefit is greater than the cost, then a policy is to be adopted. So let's take a look at the death penalty. Starting with the cost. The cost is very high. On average, it costs $2 million per person more for an execution than for putting the person in prison for life. $2 million. And that doesn't even include the appeals process, which pushes that figure up even higher. That's your taxpayer money that's being diverted from such programs as crime prevention. Okay, well, like I said, if the benefits are greater than the cost, then the policy can be adopted. Let's look at the benefit. One of the benefits that those who are for the death penalty state, as they just stated, is deterrence. Now, one of the studies that I looked at was a New York Times study done in 2001, which states that the 12 states that don't have the death penalty actually have a far lower homicide rate than the states that do have the death penalty. But that's just one argument. There's another argument, and that's peace of mind. Society gets a peace of mind from knowing that a murderer has been killed. Well, here's another figure. As Mr. Hawkins mentioned, since 1976, 102 people who were sent to death row were later found innocent. That's 102 people who might have been killed. I don't know about you, but that certainly doesn't give me peace of mind. From an economic perspective, the death penalty just doesn't make sense. The costs far outweigh the benefits. Now let's turn to international relations. The U.S. is actually in a minority in the international community with the death penalty. There are 111 countries in the world without the death penalty, and 84, including the U.S., with the death penalty. The U.S. is actually the only Western industrialized nation with the death penalty, and actually has the fifth highest execution rate. Who are the top four? China, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. Is that really the company that we want to keep? Because of this view by the international community, a lot of foreign policy and foreign international law has been written in such a way to preserve life. You have the United Nations Convention on Human Rights, which guarantees the preservation of life. You have the UN Declaration on the Rights of a Child, which says that children under the age of 18 should not face capital punishment. Well, in the United States, if you're under 18, you do face capital punishment. In fact, 2% of death row is juvenile offenders. There are only three other countries that execute children: Congo, Iran, and Pakistan. What else do we violate? Well, even the International War Crimes Tribunal won't execute people. That means people who've committed crimes as heinous as genocide will not face the death penalty because the international community believes that the death penalty is morally wrong. Well, what does this mean to the United States? We can do whatever we want by way of foreign policy, right? Well, it does have implications. Two I'm going to cite. The first is after September 11th, we've seen a problem with extradition. Members of the European Union have signed the European Convention on Human Rights, which states that those people who have committed crimes will not face capital punishment. A lot of our European Union allies have been refusing to extradite members of the Al-Qaeda terrorist cell to the United States because their nationals will face the death penalty here. That creates a problem for the United States to administer justice. There's a second problem that this creates, and that's the fact that the United States has always promoted itself as the pillar of democracy, of liberty, of forward thinking. Clearly, such human rights violations are a blemish on the United States. The death penalty just doesn't make sense. It's not good foreign policy, and it's poor economic policy. Today, when you vote, I hope you will vote against the death penalty. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "An eye for an eye, and soon we will all be blind." Thank you.
God, do we educate them. Our student debater for the negative side is Zachary Caseglia.
This kid was just 13. The pictures of him show a freckle-faced, eager scamp, maybe getting new sneakers for Christmas, rushing to grow up, hungry for life, hungry to get on with things. Soon there would be a new car, maybe, freedom, maybe. I imagine he was the kind of kid who'd pull a prank and then run for it. But when he stayed up late and fell asleep on the couch, you could probably pick him up in your arms and carry him upstairs and wipe away damp hair from his forehead, still warm with his intensity and his dreams. I'll bet he loved his mom deep down, no matter what he said when his friends were around. His last waking minutes, it seems, were spent staring up and being brutally violated for someone's lust. And when his human dignity was gone, his innocence sullied, he felt something sharp plunge into his chest, and another plunge, and another, gasping, thrashing, his life in this world about to end. He must have twisted frantically like a trapped dog being smothered. And then, darkness. His limp child's body, no longer worth the pleasure, was thrown into a drainage pond behind his house. These are the words of David Murray, reprinted in Jeff Jacoby's January 12, 1996 Boston Globe column titled, "A Killer Lives, a Child Dies." Mr. Smith was describing the murder of Jonathan Hall of Springfield, Virginia. That sharp plunge Jonathan felt in his chest, that was a screwdriver used to brutally butcher his body. His killer was out on mandatory parole. His killer was 43 years old. His killer had already spent 25 of those previous 43 years behind bars, serving multiple sentences for murder, malicious wounding, maiming, and kidnapping. A known murderer was out on parole. And Mr. Hawkins starts by asking a question tonight. Why do we kill people to show that killing is wrong? Well, I too ask myself a question when I read stories like this. And you should ask yourselves the same question tonight. How? How can the affirmative, how can so-called death penalty abolitionists stand here and advocate saving the lives of killers when innocent people have their lives taken every day? But let's take a step back, though. Tonight we are asked, should the death penalty be abolished? No, it should not. Now first, I contend that the death penalty cannot be abolished because for the most serious crimes, those most heinous crimes in our society, there is no other just punishment. Now you may think that Jonathan Hall's murder with its sensational, sickening facts is just an exception to the rule, is just one out of thousands and millions, but that's not the case. In the course of my research and preparation for tonight, I found case after unheralded case of brutal, vicious, premeditated murder. And a huge chunk of these cases were repeat criminals who were preying on our nation's weakest, our children. A few days ago, a Ventura County, California case was brought to my attention. There, a 2-year-old girl was kidnapped, raped, sodomized, and then strangled to death. Her killer, by his own admission, had over the course of 20 years raped and molested more than 100 children. In response to this case, the Ventura County District Attorney said, "I am convinced that there are some crimes that demand a sentence of death." Of course, there are the more high-profile cases that we hear about every day, where the death penalty seems to be the only appropriate punishment. For the Timothy McVeighs of the world, for the Osama bin Ladens of the world, for the alleged Beltway snipers. Our gut tells us here, our gut tells us that even a sentence of death is letting these guys off easy. There are some crimes where no other punishment is just. Now, this may be hard for us to digest. It should be hard for us to digest. We don't like the idea of our nation murdering in our name. But the death penalty is not state-sanctioned murder. It is like war, our nation using force to protect us, its people. War. Now that might seem like a stretch. But ladies and gentlemen, we have a war going on our streets. We have convicted murderers getting paroled and killing again. We have convicted murderers killing their fellow inmates while they're in prison. We have people blowing up federal buildings and flying planes into buildings. We have people killing because of their victims' race and religion and sexual orientation. We have people using screwdrivers as deadly weapons. We have a war on our streets, and these people are our enemies. Now, Mr. Hawkins, he calls the death penalty irrevocable, and it is. It will ensure that known murderers never murder again. Now, let's take a step back and reevaluate some of the affirmative's arguments. The affirmative argues that the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment, and thus a violation of the United States Constitution. But here's a newsflash. The proposed alternative, life imprisonment, is no less cruel and no less unusual than a sentence of death. Prisons are nasty places, nasty. And the affirmative would have you think that places like Angola are motels where vicious murderers have their civil liberties coddled. But that's not the case. I think, however, the most disappointing flaw in the affirmative's argument is that they allow their righteous regard for human life get in the way of their righteous regard for human life. Now, I want to go back to David Murray's words, who was describing Jonathan Hall's murder earlier. Death penalty abolitionists, he says, well, they're always there to protest when some butcher on death row is facing the chair, always there to denounce the system, demand justice, disinterested civil libertarians serving the underdog. Well, this underdog's name was Jonathan. He was denied his life because a killer was turned loose rather than executed. No system of justice in recorded history has ever equated the life of a murdered innocent child with that of a homicidal depraved predator. Ladies and gentlemen, the system envisioned by the affirmative, it does just that. Thank you.
I hope the two of them don't form a law firm, and if they do, that they're on my side. Our next debater for the affirmative side is Diane Russ Tierney.
The death penalty should be abolished because it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it is not a deterrent. We've heard something about that, and I want to touch on it a little bit. But it also doesn't work because it's not fair. Now, we can all agree, particularly in hearing some of the terrible crimes and agreeing that there ought to be punishment, that a punishment only has value if it's applied fairly, if it's applied to the wrong people, as we've heard, or if it's applied on the basis of immoral reasons like race or class, the punishment loses its value. And that is exactly how the death penalty is applied today. Let's talk about fairness. The death penalty is rigged by race and by class. Let's talk about class first. There's an old saying that goes, them that's got the capital don't get the punishment. And what that means is, if you can afford to hire a lawyer who knows the law, who comes to meet with you, who investigates your case, and then who zealously defends your rights in court, chances are you won't get the death penalty. But if you're poor and you have to take the lawyer that the state gives you, and that lawyer doesn't know the law, doesn't come to meet with you, doesn't investigate your case, chances are you're going to get the death penalty. Sleeping lawyers. In Texas, there's a problem with sleeping lawyers. I want to just tell you about one case. There's a case in Texas where the lawyer fell asleep during the trial. I mean, really fell asleep. Mouth open, fell asleep. And during a recess, somebody asked this lawyer, did you fall asleep during your client's trial? And the lawyer said, yes. It was boring. When the defendant in the case objected to the fact that his lawyer fell asleep during the trial, the trial judge said, well, the Constitution says you have to have a lawyer. It doesn't say he has to be awake. And that's just not one sort of off-the-wall judge. As it turns out, as I said, there's a problem with sleeping lawyers in Texas. There was another case, a case by the where the defendant's name was Calvin Burdeen, and his lawyer fell asleep. And when he raised this case, it went on up to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit said, well, we're not so sure that it is a problem that your lawyer fell asleep, because we don't know that he fell asleep during the important parts of your death penalty trial. Well, fortunately, the Fifth Circuit thought about it again, and they reversed themselves. But the state of Texas went all the way up to the Supreme Court to say, wait a minute, Supreme Court, you know, we're not sure it's a constitutional violation for a lawyer to fall asleep in a case unless he can prove that he, in fact, fell asleep during the important parts of the trial. There's a problem. That shows you how the quality of counsel is not valued. It's not just sleeping lawyers, though. Lawyers who represent poor people in these cases are disproportionately lawyers who are disbarred. We have lawyers who don't know that there was a case called Furman versus Georgia in 1972, don't know that there are two parts to a capital trial, a guilt or innocence phase where you figure out whether the person did it, and a phase where you do the discussion about whether the death penalty is important or appropriate, the penalty phase. You have lawyers who don't investigate the case. There's a case of a woman by the name of Wanda Jean Allen who was executed in Oklahoma, and her case is a particular tragedy because the Supreme Court has now said you can't execute a person like Wanda Jean Allen. The Supreme Court has said you cannot execute a person with mental retardation. And even before then, mental retardation was the kind of mitigating evidence, the kind of evidence a jury might consider to decide maybe the death penalty wasn't appropriate. But her lawyer never knew she had mental retardation, never investigated her case. Why? He was only paid $800. He didn't have the funds to investigate the case, and he didn't. And in fact, when he went to court and said, look, you know, I didn't expect this case to be a death penalty case, and so I need some help now that it's a death penalty case. The court said, sorry, no help. And he said, well, you know, I've only been paid $800. I can't do what I need to do and investigate this case. The court said, sorry. And the court said, when he said, give me the money to investigate the case, the court said no. And so this lawyer gave Wanda Jean Allen $800 worth of representation and never discovered and never found and never presented to a jury information that the state had in its possession to show that this woman had mental retardation and severe mental impairment that explained, didn't excuse, but explained the violence in her life and what had happened and might have saved her life. That's the kind of lawyers that we have in death penalty cases. I want to talk about the issue of race. The death penalty is rigged by race. The single most important factor in determining whether or not you get a death sentence is not the kinds of things that we would think about, whether you have a prior criminal record, whether you were particularly cruel to the victim, whether you used a gun or a screwdriver or whatever. Those are not the kinds of things that determine who gets a death sentence and who doesn't. The thing that determines whether you get a death sentence or not is race. Now, I've heard the arguments about studies that I've done or studies that some of us who are opponents of the death penalty have done, but I want to talk to you about a study that was done by the General Accounting Office, which is the arm of Congress. If they don't, well, in theory, I guess they do work for me, but they don't take direction from me. And the General Accounting Office reviewed studies from all over the country. Virtually every death penalty state that has looked at this issue has found that there's racial discrimination in the application of the death penalty. The General Accounting Office said, you know, race influences these cases at every stage of the process, from the decision to charge a case as a capital case for the prosecutor all the way through. The General Accounting Office, a neutral arbiter of whether or not there's a problem, they have said that the death penalty is applied in a racially discriminatory way and that the most prevalent kind of discrimination is race of victim discrimination. We've heard a lot about victims, and we've talked about the value of a punishment. What does it say about a punishment that values some victims more than others? Homicide victims in this country are broken down just about evenly. People of color, white victims. And yet, 80% of the people who've been sentenced to death have been sentenced to death for the murder of white victims. And that's been as long as we've had the death penalty. That number has not changed. And so we have a system that places a premium on the lives of white victims and doesn't speak to victims of color. And that's a problem, because if we're making a statement with the death penalty, what statement are we making? I want to talk a little bit about deterrence. I think we've had a very good argument laid out, but I want to just talk about using our common sense. These econometric studies that were listed on and on and on, the experts in the field who've examined those studies have found them to be greatly flawed. And you don't have to be a genius in econometrics to sort of understand the basic flaw. The basic flaw in the whole deterrence argument is that people who are engaged in murder are engaged in some kind of cost-benefit analysis. And that might work when you're dealing with cost-benefit analysis in terms of policy, but people engaged in murder are not engaged in that. You know, most murders are committed in the heat of passion, when somebody is not sitting around thinking about, well, if I commit this crime, I'm going to get a death sentence. That's not happening. And even those people who say, well, what about the contract murderer? What about the person who is stealthily going around? Those people think they're slick. They don't believe they're going to get caught. So the death penalty can't be a deterrent in that case either. And finally, if you just think about the whole basis of deterrence, now anybody who is an expert in deterrence will say, deterrence comes from a punishment that is swift and sure. Well, the death penalty is anything but that. It can't be. It's inherently unable to be that way. And that's because our process requires us to be thoughtful, deliberative, to try and get it right, and we don't do it that way. And so it can't be swift and sure. We only apply it to a handful, and the only way to change that is for us to get the murderer and take him out back and shoot him. But none of us want that system. The death penalty should be abolished because it doesn't work. It's not a deterrent, and it sends the wrong signal. It sends the signal that race and class can determine the punishment and not the crime.
The next debater for the negative proposition is Ronald Rischlock.
These are important issues, and I'm glad we're talking about them. When we, I couldn't help but think, though, as we start talking about the possibility of guilty people going free, innocent people being convicted,